This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm Harry Kreisler, host of Conversations with History. Today's lecture is sponsored by the Institute of International Studies and the Sanford Elberg Endowment, which was established in 1987 by the Institute of International Studies in honor of Sanford S. Elberg, Emeritus Professor of Medical Microbiology and Immunology and Emeritus Dean of the Graduate Division. It honors his tireless efforts and substantial achievements in building the excellence of graduate education at Berkeley, including his support for international studies. Previous lecturers have included Sadaka Ogata, Hanan Ashwari, Robert McNamara, Alexander Yakovalev, Wole Soyinka, Fang Li Zhur, Tariq Ali, Christopher Hitchens, and Richard Goldstone, among others. Today's focus will be on movies, politics, and history. Our Elberg lecturer is Oliver Stone. A prolific and innovative filmmaker, Oliver Stone has been nominated for 10 Academy Awards and has won 3 Oscars for writing Midnight Express, for screenwriting, and for directing Born on the 4th of July and Platoon. He has directed 20 feature films, written the screenplay for most of his films, and also for other films, including Scarface and Midnight Express, and produced movies and television programs. Intense, provocative, thoughtful, his films are cinema which jolts our senses and stretches our imagination, forcing us to confront our illusions about who we are and what we know. Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, Between Heaven and Earth, Salvador, JFK, Nixon, W, Wall Street, and Natural Born Killers, to name a few, or in a sense, often conversations with history, engaging the most important political, social, and economic issues of our times. More recently, in his 12-part documentary series, The Hidden History of the United States, and in his feature film, Alexander, he explores the journey of visionary leaders and their search for a world based on compassion, peace, and global unity and diversity. Stone wrote a novel, A Child's Dream, based on his experience as a young man. And with Peter Kutznick, he has co-authored the book, The Untold Story of the United States. Mr. Stone served in the U.S. Army Infantry in Vietnam. He was wounded twice and was decorated with the Bronze Star for valor and a Purple Heart. Oliver Stone's new movie, Snowden, will be released this fall. Please join me in welcoming Oliver Stone to Berkeley. When I invited you here, Oliver, you said you like to come to Berkeley. Why?
Free spirit.
Free spirit.
I remember the late 60s, and it was the place you didn't go to. I mean, I grew up conservative, as you know, so I went to Yale briefly and NYU, but Berkeley was always scary. That was where Mario Savio
started,
and he's still going, I gather. Right?
He passed away, but his ideals still live on.
And all the girls were very pretty, you know. It was California, you know. The West was the best, as Jim Morrison said. So to me, as a New Yorker, cold and clustered little buildings and small apartments, it seemed like a dream.
I'd like to talk a little first about some of your formative experiences. And I, in reading about you, there was a real quest throughout your life, especially as a young adult, to learn and to read and to experience life. Tell us a little about that.
Well, you know, I was an only child, and I think that has a lot to do with it, because and my father was a curious man. I always had read a lot, and my mother, in another way, in an experiential way, she was very curious about the other side of life, so she had a very social life. But I read a lot, and I was fascinated by writing. My father used to pay me a quarter for a theme. I was interested in getting the quarter back in those days, because the quarter was the could buy me a classic comic. And you could always read. You remember classic comics were always wonderful comics that were all from the great literature of the time, but they were very nicely drawn. And so I wrote these themes, and then I didn't care about the writing because it was difficult just to get the money. But over time, I appreciated it, and I went back to writing in my spare time in the summer. Actually, I started to write a novel when I was about 14. Finally, I completed a novel when I was 19, and it was rejected everywhere, and of course set up a whole series of, I'm never going to do this again, I'll never be a novelist, and I don't want to write novels. And I took off for other adventures.
And you read people, great authors like Hemingway and Conrad and the Greeks, and you basically from it got the travel bug. So, and you wanted to experience life and to see what the world was like.
Yeah, and that was a thing in those days, you know, to have adventure, to do as many jobs as you could, go abroad. And when I you know, my parents got a divorce, and my life, in a sense, because it was a small family, it fell apart. So there was, my mother was living in another place, my father here. And I thought, I really was not a content, I was not a happy kid, and I wanted to go. And when I read the Conrad, I read Hemingway, and all these adventures abroad, especially the sea, I was fascinated by the ocean. And Conrad was a very evocative, moody atmosphere that he created. I ended up in the Merchant Marine. I don't know if many people know that, but I was a wiper for about a few months out of Asia, and I came back to Oregon on a long voyage, a 38-day voyage, something like that. It was a very dangerous voyage because we were traveling empty in the North Pacific in January.
And you then taught school in Vietnam. Then you enlisted and applied for combat, and you've told that story in a way in the movie Platoon.
In a way, yes. In a way, the novel was written when I was 19. Before I enlisted, I volunteered. I had been in Vietnam as a teacher and in the Merchant Marine and various other things, but I ended up. In other words, the novel was written before the experience, but it was based on imagination. And the novel's interesting because it precedes a lot of the things that happened later on, but is obviously a romantic interpretation of war, whereas when I went as a soldier, it became more, what I did over there became more evident when I did Platoon, which was more realistic.
And what you got out of that Vietnam experience you told me 20 years ago when I did our first interview was really to question authority, if I can paraphrase what you said, and that experience of being a soldier, but then coming back and experiencing the anti-war movement added to your education. And then your third movie really reflects your understanding of, well, let's focus on the Vietnamese and what's being done to them.
Well, you're jumping a little ahead. That's true. But when I came back from Vietnam, I was not like Ron Kovic in Born on the 4th of July. I was not an anti-war demonstrator. I hadn't made that crossover yet. I was confused. I was traumatized. I guess I had PTSD without knowing what it was. And, you know, it took me a while. You know, I was raised very conservative, and I was anti-Kennedy. I was anti-Roosevelt. I was against all those people that became heroes, in a way, in the untold history of the United States that you talked about earlier. But I really supported my father's point of view, and it took me a long time to get away from it, a long time. And that was a big battle of the 70s and the 80s. By the time Reagan came into office, really it was in the 80s during the Central American Wars that I really became angry, in the sense that I had never quite been before, because I saw in the Central America, I saw especially in Honduras, a lot of American soldiers, they were warming up to go into Nicaragua. If you remember correctly, there was plans for an invasion of Nicaragua because they wanted to bring down that government, which they considered communist. So it was an ugly war, the Contra War. And all those, it was, now there were, of course, women in the military, so it was a really, it was a strange thing to see again. All the veterans who'd come out of Vietnam, I think not all, but many of them felt that the wars were over, that we had reached a sanity, that we had seen through the war in Vietnam. There was so much criticism of it that it was amazing to me to be going right back into it. And that, I didn't realize, preceded what happened after the 80s. You know, I didn't see all of this coming. None of us did. We thought the country was on a different curve after Vietnam. But you're talking about a film called 1994, which was called Heaven and Earth. And that was came out of my Vietnam films. And I went back with Lely Haislip, who had written a book called Between Heaven and Earth. And with her, I went through her story, which is an amazing story. She was on both sides. She was both... had to be on both sides. She had to work with the Vietnamese government at the same time she was working with the people who were controlling her village, which were the Viet Cong at that time. So it's a fascinating book, and I think the movie is one of my best. Unfortunately, when it came out in the United States, although it was beautifully shot and cost quite a bit of money, it was not appreciated because nobody really cared about the Vietnamese people. And I still don't see much evidence of that, you know, that there's any sense of apology for what happened in those years.
In the DVD of Alexander, which we will talk about a little later, you make the suggestion that the audience watch it in two stages and bring back the intermission that we older folks knew from the 1950s. Yeah. And so for this interview, I went back and watched a number of your movies, and that rule in a way applies to some of your other movies, for example, Heaven and Earth. And I mean that as a compliment, because the parts are so rich that there's so much information that you have to take in as you watch the movie, but if you break it up, so that's meant as a compliment.
Those who know JFK, I mean, I felt like there was a complete fountain of information, especially at the midway point. He meets Donald Sutherland, who plays Mr. X, and they have a 12-minute dialogue, I believe, and Sutherland swamps him with a new level of information of federal policy and history that is overwhelming, and I think we should have had a break there. And they did in Holland and various countries in Europe where they allow intermissions, but the American system was geared towards turnover and money, so it's really hard to absorb all that information and keep going.
I want to talk a little about making movies. And the first thing I want to ask you about is you personally, and you've already suggested this, how are you changed by the movies that you make personally?
Me?
Yeah.
Enormously. Everyone is a method. You know, like an actor goes through a role, you know, you can ask an actor, does he become a part of that role? Yes. Does he forget about it afterward? Yes and no. I mean, you have to move on in your life, but you never forget. I can tell you, if you asked me what you were doing in 1984, 87, 93, I would remember that year specifically, not so much by the age of my children or the wives I had, but I'd remember them by the movies I did. I suppose I was wedded to my movies, and each one was a painful and sometimes a divorce experience in the sense that you go through it and then you all break apart again. You don't see the same people again. Crews break apart. They go to work on other movies. They forget things. And actors move on. So it was a wonderful experience, very beautiful. At the same time, it's painful because you have to say goodbye.
And if we look at the whole, your journey, which will keep coming down, you're changing in the way you view the world and the values that you think are important. Is that fair?
Enormously. Yeah. Enormously. I mean, I made two horror films, and they were the best I could do in the 70s and 80s. Michael Caine was in The Hand, which a psychological horror film. And then after that, I'd written a few scripts, and I'd been criticized for having right-wing views, which wasn't true, but Scarface was criticized for that, as was Conan the Barbarian. I went to Salvador with a friend, Richard Boyle, my co-writer. He was a journalist, and he'd been in Vietnam, too. A real troublemaker. He used to work for KPF.
KPFA.
Yeah, the Pacifica Radio. I loved Richard, and I still do. He's a character, and he took me on a trip to Central America like Hunter Thompson must have gone through, because we were really on the edge. We were driving down crazy roads, hanging out with strange people. I think we were in danger a few times, and it was an exciting experience. And also I saw a world that I had forgotten about in a way, the Vietnam world. Because, you know, when you come back from Vietnam and you've been there for a long time, you kind of want to forget about it. It's just, it was done. And anyway, and nobody was making those movies at that time. Remember this, there had been no, I got Platoon Mate 10 years after I wrote the screenplay. I thought it was dead. Mm-hmm. And also Born the 4th of July was 10 years after it was written. So Vietnam was not a subject matter in the United States to be realistic about. You could make mythopoetic movies like Deer Hunter and Apocalypse, which I love, but they were not on the realist level that I was talking about.
And Platoon was a transformative experience for the country.
It was, yeah. Sure it was, because it was a huge international hit. After years of rejection, so many screenplays rejected, suddenly to have this small little budgeted film in the Philippines come out, and nobody could stop it. There was no criticism. It was like the time was right. It was that weird moment we all have in time when you're just in the wind and it all intersects.
And less so on Platoon, but on Salvador, one gets the sense that you were doing it on a wing, and on the one hand, and also money is always a problem, financing throughout your career, because the big bucks, especially in the United States, find you problematic. Is that the word?
Well, I'm trying to defy categorization, so you always try to be elusive, but my heart was in the Salvador, and Salvador was a subject matter that is anathema to Americans. I've never seen a successful, maybe there's been recently, a successful Latin American or Central American film. They don't seem to cross the border. And Salvador had no different fate. I mean, it was a very radical film. It was very strong and colorful. And I hope some of you can see it, because it really is a fun movie. It died on box office. It just died right away. The New York Times gave it the usual review, like, you know, this is liberal, this is radical fiction and stuff like that. But we actually just did no business until the video came out, and then we really did some amazing business because Platoon had come out. So we released two films in that year. Platoon was an enormous success in December 86. So, as you know, I think I got nominated for two writing nominations for Platoon and for Salvador same year. But Salvador has been forgotten, and it's a shame, because the same thing is going on pretty much all the time. It repeats itself over and over again. Insofar as we as a government help the repressive sides of those governments in third world countries to always triumph. Most recently it happened in Honduras when Hillary Clinton backed the military in their takeover of the Zelaya in 2011, it was. Maybe it was 2009.
As we pursue this subject of making movies, I want to talk to you about your relationship with actors.
You are jumping around very fast, Harry. You've gotten faster since 86.
Yeah.
these are big
Well, as
subjects.
You get older, you got to get younger, or you're not going to make it. All of your DVDs have extraordinarily interesting documentaries attached to them. This is true of Platoon. It's true of Wall Street. And one of the things that comes out is when the actors talk about you, they say that you guide them, maybe terrorize them in a way that raises the bar for them. And so you have been able over the years to direct sort of some of the greatest actors of our time, especially American actors. And when they look back, they say, gee whiz, you know, he really led me to a place. I've heard Michael Douglas say that. I've heard Blake Lively say that. Johnny Depp, and on and on. What's your secret?
Well, it's in here. I'll pull it out later. When it's an interesting answer, but frankly, it's I don't think of it that way. I mean, I love. You don't have to be. Ilya Kazan comes to mind as a great director of actors. On the other hand, Alfred Hitchcock was not a great director of actors. So, you know, it doesn't. What really matters to me is the vision you have. If you have the vision, you stay with that vision and keep an intent. Other people will find a way, if they're interested, to share it with you. That comes across. So, above all, it's intention to the vision of what you are going for. And once you have that in your mind, and it's got to be like a laser, because you're going to get torn apart by all the naysayers and all the questions, and it gets complicated on me. But if you really have a strong vision, it carries. People see it, they join in. And I would say to the actors, you know, I can be critical at times. I would say directly to an actor, you know, I just think that sucks, you know. But, it's about that take, you know, and we talk about it, but I won't say it publicly. We'll just take them to the side. I don't know what you're doing out there, you know. This is not what we're. So we talk about it again. But hopefully all that gets ironed out in the rehearsal process, because that saves a lot of money. If you got to do it on the stage with a lot of people, it's very tricky. But every actor does lose his way at some point. I mean, even an expert, a master like Anthony Hopkins on Nixon, would get very shaky sometimes, very scared. It's very scary to play those kind of roles, and where you're being publicly judged as a man who's known by millions. So, you know, I think that you have to play a role, also a little bit of a lot sometimes of a helper, of a guide. And I always tell my actors, you know, during this period we're making this movie, you will never find a better friend than me. I am really rooting for you. I have no intention to have a separate role than to really guide you, because my performance is in your performance. We are mutually on
organic.
This road together.
Yeah.
And if you look bad, I'll look bad.
You say, I believe it's in the documentary for Platoon, you say, what you look for is some matching spirit. That is in the real character that you want in the actor, because there's a spirit to the script.
That's the key decision you could make. I can tell you that all the casting in the world, boy, it comes to that. It's the first thing. It's that who should play this role? And you kind of have to wrestle with yourself, because you're going to get tempted by movie stars. You're going to be tempted by the budget. You can get a bigger budget with a bigger star and so forth. And so all the wrong reasons are presented for you to miss with the film. And I have missed. But, I'm sorry, the question was exactly what?
Well, the spirit.
Yeah, for example.
Finding the spirit in the actor.
Yeah, for example, Elias. He was in Platoon.
In Platoon.
He's an Indian. He was an Indian, an Apache. I knew him. He was killed. And there was no Indian I could find at that time. There was just not. They may have been, but I couldn't find them. I looked everywhere. And Defoe was a Norwegian. Strange mix. He had nothing. He didn't have at all the qualities of the dark hair, Jim Morrison look that Elias had. But he had definite quality. There was something about Willem Defoe, the cheekbones, the exoticness of his look. So I said, well, I'll settle for this. I'll do this because I have a feeling his spirit is good. He'd also played bad guys, if you remember, up to that point. So it was kind of good to play him off as a more noble individual. So this happened a few times, quite a few times. Michael Douglas was known, I guess, as a lightweight romantic actor. I liked him very much in his Romancing the Stone series, but putting him in the movie was a heavyweight thing. And he had to know long dialogues. He'd never done long dialogues. He'd done TV. So we had to clash a bit for him to get down. And
he
really
won the Academy Award.
And buckle down and concentrate on this. So you have to know your lines before you get to the set. There's there was a lot of instances of this. I don't know how many you want, but it goes on right down to, right down to the present.
In Alexander, I'm going to put a plug in there. There are two great documentaries in the new ultra version of Alexander, which makes an extraordinary presentation. One of the documentaries is done by Oliver Sun, and in there he follows Oliver around and shows what he does as director and screenwriter and so on. Val Kilmer is interviewed on the subject of acting, and he says that he calls you a friendly fascist. So I thought that was a nice thing in your son's...
I don't know. My daughter calls me that, too. What do you do? Because you're directing, you're in the position of control, but I don't... I never want to be a bully, and I'm sure sometimes I appear that way. But it's a hard job, and you have to have... It has to click like an army because the budgets are never big for my films. They're always, like, tight. And I have to have a schedule, and we have to make things like a military. And sometimes that doesn't work because it's too complicated or we don't get it. But I've never had a lot of slack. And I like the actors, but, you know, Val and I fought it out on The Doors, as you know. But he did a great job on The Doors, and then he came. I had him back for playing a king. That was a weird off-casting, but I think it worked for me. By the way, you should clarify to the audience, because I don't think they understand that Alexander had three incarnations. There was
the movie.
The
yeah.
2004 theatrical release I didn't like because I was rushed, and basically rushed it out to meet Warner Brothers standards and cut a lot of the sex and cut for length. The 2007 version, which I think you saw, is a wholly different structure, a much longer film with an intermission. The 2014 version, called the ultimate cut, not the final cut, is the version you're talking about with my son's documentary is on there. And 2014 is my favorite one, and that has an intermission. It allows you to build the character, and it also allows to breathe. You need to breathe in it. This is a historical epic. It's a great story. It has validity today, but it took 10 years to make it. Anyway,
this raises an interesting point because when one observes what you do in a film, one thinks of you maybe as a director, the director Oliver Stone. But you are a man of multiple talents who is sort of supervising running several operations. And you talk about the role of screenwriter, which you do for a lot of your movies, the role of director, directing the actors, the action, and so on, and then finally, the editing. And so in a way, what you just described about the Alexander DVD is a way to appreciate that, because here is somebody constantly thinking what he did under pressure from the studios with regard to the first version.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you have to realize the timing sucked. 2004, we invaded Baghdad in 2003. And so did Alexander, and you invented Babylon. But people were making parallels between him and Bush, and it was the last, because Bush was a military incompetent, and Alexander was a military genius, and huge difference, as well as a vision of the world. He married, Alexander's vision was to marry the Oriental with the Greek, and to make a culture that would work for all cultures, would be tolerant, a much liberal culture. And he didn't steal like so many Westerners do from the East. He left the treasures, many of them there, and he put his capital there, and that was going to be the capital of his empire, and he was going to stay there because he also intermingled the armies, remember that? And he took Persian brides and Bactrian brides. This was a man who had a vision that was beyond the scope of most people of that age who were stuck in, I'm a Westerner, I'm a Greek, what do I want to do with these Orientals? They're slaveholders, and well, they're torture. They're into all these horrible practices that we.
Which raises an interesting point. Let's talk about screenwriting, because a component of your screenwriting is the research, and you are a voracious reader and a high energy researcher. So when you undertake something like JFK or Alexander to compare the two, you are sifting through all the data that's out there. You're reading the historians. The Alexander, I'll go back to that, the DVD has a section, the history of Alexander, about a 30-minute film, where you interview all of the prominent historians on Alexander. But talk about that problem of research, and then what do you add to the research when you accumulate it?
Well, that's a good question. Robin Lane Fox, who wrote one of the best Alexander books in 1973 as a young Oxford historian, was our main advisor. And Robin vetted the script. And we had, at the end of the day, there was a lot of people we consulted in England and also in the United States. But we did too much research, and that's always the problem. You know, with, for example, Wall Street, too much research. And sometimes you regret it because it's too factual. Sometimes it gets overloaded. What you end up doing is stripping out a lot of the research and going back. That happened, for example, on Snowden. I am not a computer expert, but I inundated myself for quite a few months with my co-writer on all the computer games that go on and the coding. Now, coding is a kind of bore, but it's very important. So how do you show computers in a way that would be exciting to an audience? This is a question that occurred to me throughout the film and worried me. And how do we do these without becoming just a computer film? And I think we found a way, but I ended up taking out about 40% of the research, which is very tricky. And there's some great stuff we have to leave on the floor. Giving it up is also part of it. Same thing happened to me on JFK, although I incorporated a lot of it, but I had also had Zach Sklar working with me. He edited Garrison's book. But JFK is a bottomless well, and it still goes on. There's a third generation of JFK researchers are out there right now who are doing very good work on that and bringing to light new things that never came out.
And I think there's an important distinction that you actually made in my interview 20 years ago about that being a dramatist versus being a historian.
Yeah.
Let's explore that a little, because it seems like you're encroaching on the historian.
Well, we argued about that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And I said to you something about dramatists know history better than some historians.
Right.
Because I pointed to the Greeks, and I said that Homer wrote this stuff about the Trojan War, and Aeschylus, and Sophocles, and Oedipus, and not Oedipus, Orestes. I'm sorry, Euripides.
Yeah.
Before Alcibiades and Herodotus.
Right, but the point
not
is
Alcibiades. I'm mixing the characters. Herodotus was the first one, and then who was the second great historian, the Greek historian? Help me, somebody.
Thucydides,
the Peloponnesian War. They both, by the way, were criticized. Thucydides quite a lot. And Herodotus, too, for throwing in stories about ape men and various fables from the East. So, you know, the dramatist and the historian, and even today, when you read histories, I mean, there's so many now, there's so many specialists. Come on, I've read enough on the untold history with World War II and the post-World War that I'm really, you have to suspect every historian, because everyone is subjective in their own way.
You probably got more criticism for JFK than any other movie.
Next to Natural Born Killers.
Oh yeah, well, that's true. But we're focusing on the historical ones. And looking back at that movie, would you have done anything differently?
It holds up pretty well. If you look at James DiEugenio's new book, Reclaiming Parkland, which I think is a very important book in this. He cites the movie for a couple of errors, but he really thinks the narrative is solid. And I think David Talbot would pretty much agree with most of what is said in that movie. I would do things sometimes differently. Yes, I think I fell for a couple of ones that were wrong. But overall, you know, when you're dealing with 500 facts and you miss a few, I mean, you got to give me some leeway. But I think we're so much closer to the truth than CBS News, ABC News, NBC News. When you see these, they did this massive invasion of our psyches in 2000, was it last year when they were doing the 60th anniversary of 63? Was it 63?
Yeah. The assassination.
They did this massive, every channel, and every one of those shows is fantasy. And they all go on with this, Oswald did it. And it's just like watching, you know, here we are inundating America with all that money, all that advertising. It's amazing. It's an amazing experience to watch that. And I hope in 100 years from now, or even 50, when some more intelligent people come around and watch this fantasy that they've strewn on the American people, I just hope that they get the scorn that they deserve. I really do.
In that movie, the beginning of the movie where you're doing the credits, there is a historical narrative, which you're deconstructing the era that Kennedy era,
yeah.
Basically,
yes.
And then you move to the feature film, and I'm curious because one of the interesting things about your work is your attachment to the documentary form. Talk a little about that In other words, you use the documentary as a way to inform the viewer about the context. Talk a little about that.
Okay, well, you've asked a very confusing question, because we did classical documentary style was Untold History of the United States. This was a 12-hour series we did for Showtime. I had a historian as my co-author, Peter Kuznick, from American University, and his staff of young researchers. We really went back from 1890s, and we examined America's imperialism abroad and America's changing attitudes and what happened, culminating in this national security state, starting with Woodrow Wilson back in the World War I period. And it really accelerates, as you know, after the Second World War. It turns into this the concept of national security dominates America. In fact, we change our laws somewhat like Nazi Germany, so that the state is more important than the individual, and the laws are adjusted accordingly to allow you to arrest anybody in the name of national security, which is what Hitler did in the 30s, basically. But we've gotten worse and worse at it, and now we're really there. We're in a police state. We don't know it. We don't call it that. As Garrison said, we never call it fascism. We call it benign. It's benign, you know. But we are in a place where they know everything about you. So this is a very disturbing movement. So, you know, this is what we were trying to document in this. And that was a huge five-year effort. I had to go back to, so to speak,
you're talking now about the new documentary.
Yeah, Untold History of the United States. Came out in 2014. I'm not so good on the dates. 14, yeah. And it was, I had to go back to graduate school to really absorb this, because I never had studied history formally. And I love this series, but it is done in the classical mode with narration, no sit-down interviews, because to get into arguments that, like they do in the standard documentary, would have made this thing impossible to do. We had to do one decade in basically 58 minutes. So we had to take a real big picture look. We ran with it. The narration is worked over image by image, and we use movies, of all things, to bridge some of the long gaps to make it easier for an audience to understand. I wanted teenagers to see this, because they don't get this history. You can only get this kind of history in graduate school, truly. And, you know, this is not a history, it's not a crackpot history we invented. This comes from the revisionism of the late 50s, early 60s, with William Appleman Williams, D.F. Fleming comes to mind, Walter Lefevre, Lloyd Gardner. This is a history that Gar Alperovitz, there's a dozen historians who've written this stuff, but no one has been able to put it in one setting and in give an overall big picture, you know, and that's what we tried to do.
We should say that the footage is extraordinary. So your staff has gathered images
from all over the world.
From all over the world, it's quite extraordinary. And I want to.
But that's classical in a way.
Yeah, but
except for the movie part.
Yeah, well, that I wanted to talk to you about. What I was trying to get at earlier was, in your feature films, you have documentaries that you have either created. For example, in Nixon, you create a pseudo-documentary, which is telling
And in JFK, too.
And in JFK, also. So there is, you like to ground your movies in documentaries.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what I found fascinating about the 12 parts was you brought the movie into the documentary.
Yeah, that's true.
And what is quite interesting is the movie scene that you have selected captures the essence of what is going on in the world. And I think you would call it the zeitgeist of the time. So, for example, when you're dealing with the Spanish Civil War, you show a scene from For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Right.
There are other examples, scenes from Spartacus and so on, Saving Private Ryan. And the point is that the movie, in this condensed scene, which captures so much, can inform now the documentary, which is a reversal of what you were doing before.
True. But notice one difference. For example, when we did the JFK movie, we dramatized and we went to the conclusions, mm-hmm. our conclusions, or particularly mine. Mm-hmm. But also many people agreed with it. Mm-hmm. But when we did the JFK as part of the Untold History of the United States, which is Chapter 6, which is We went right up to the lip of the assassination. We never went to the assassination. We gave you all the reasons, what Kennedy was doing, why he had, there was a motive to kill him. And we set the whole atmosphere and let it go. And we let you assume what happened in Dallas. If you want to believe the Warren Commission, that's fine. But we, in other words, we didn't make that leap. Mm-hmm. Which we could do in drama. We couldn't do that in this series. We have to conform to the facts that happened as they were reported at the time in these archives.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I think in the documentary I get a better sense of what you think Kennedy represented, actually, than I got in JFK.
Yeah, but go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say there is a theme running through your documentaries that I want to bring out, which it culminates in this new 12-part series, The Hidden History of the U.S., and that is learning, basically. In other words, you carved out a niche as a learner. Well, what's really going on here? You know, what is there to know about our experience? What are we being told? You know, even onto who am I? So it's very interesting because in the documentary, what you say is Kennedy was learning, basically. Yeah. And you document that in all the events with amazing footage, which so leading up to the American University speech, where he's really... This is somebody who could be, could achieve the impossible.
Yes. I think that he would have ended the Cold War. I think that Khrushchev and him had an extraordinary relationship as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it was moving in that direction. You see, Kennedy had a lot of guts, and people missed that point. He'd been in the military, although he'd been a junior commander. And he had the people who ran the Pentagon in the late 50s, early 60s hated him, because they thought he was a punk, you know, he was just changing the rules. And the rules had been set by Eisenhower. So by taking on the military, this at the Bay of Pigs, and then again in Laos, and then again invading Cuba, and then finally on the Vietnam issue, these are major steps for a young president to do. And we show the cost of that. He somewhere along the line signed his death warrant. And I think that's a very important point that's missed by so many of the critics at that time. And I think that Fletcher Prouty was the one who pointed me to it. He was the focal point officer between the CIA and the Air Force and the military, because he had to provide the military hardware that they used and all their misadventures abroad. So he told me a lot, and that's where I really had my head turned, really turned. One more point. I did the other documentaries are just their visits, you know, like going to see Castro and sitting there with him and actually letting the American people feel what he's like, or letting them feel what the Israeli leaders are like, or Arafat. We see Netanyahu in that one.
And I wanted to address that because I watched those documentaries, and what the sense that I had was you were saying, God, this is a complex problem, the search for peace in the Middle East. What is Castro doing with human rights? You know, there's an issue here. At least he's being accused of things. And it's like you put a cameraman and then we're following you as you explore the complexity.
Spontaneous.
Yeah, but it's again this self-learning.
Yeah, it's a learning
process. You're learning, but you want us to learn. Is that fair?
Yeah. I'd like you to. I mean, a lot of people didn't want to hear about it or see it. I mean, in fact, Comandante was advertised by HBO. It was going to go on the air in 2 weeks. I was very proud of that, and then they pulled it.
That's about Castro.
Yeah, the first one, Comandante. Mm-hmm. It was a 90-minute feature, and they pulled it. They told me a bunch of stuff about... Anyway, the point is that they pulled it, and they never even informed me, but it was very depressing. And then I went back, and I did a second one that was much tougher. My first one was a visit. You know, let us feel what he's like. We don't even know who Castro is. He doesn't give interviews that Americans see. Unfortunately, it was not seen because the Cuban right wing in Miami was so vociferous. They promised HBO they'd cancel all their subscriptions, etc. And that always works with the American. It's just depressing. But also, don't forget the Chavez story, which was another one where the south of the border did get out. Mm-hmm. It did get out as a theatrical documentary in 2009.
And it's on HBO.
But God,
Netflix. It's on Netflix.
No, it was released by an independent.
Oh, okay.
It did get out But the abuse that I took on that one, I never was booked on National Public Radio after that. I used to get booked all the time. When we had Untold History, Peter and I couldn't get on any of them, and anyone. And we knew a lot of people from the locals would wanted us on, but there was national policy. They wouldn't, I'm sure they won't admit it, but we could never get a booking, which is a strange thing after you've been on there so many times.
But before
and that was because I had a rough interview on their radio show in 2009 with defending Chavez, who they had taken a policy about, that he was a dictator and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was a depressing time, and it's continued this way because NPR has been politicized. KPFK is a different deal. They may be part of the...
KPFA.
They have done us wonderful things, and they were great on Untold History and run prizes and all that. They continue to.
But before we talk about the 12-part, because there are certain themes that emerge that actually appear in your movies, but I do want to talk a minute about screenwriting, which was the other component. And you're a voracious screenwriter. Many of your screenplays are not made into movies. But writing is, for you, very important.
Yeah.
A key part of that process.
I think
process.
It is the key. I think directing is a magic art. But there's so many elements involved. You need collaborators, and I think there's something about the writing process that is very unique, and it's a solo flying act. And for some reason, I've always associated editing with rewriting, because I guess I'm experimental in a lot of ways. I try things; they flop sometimes on the stage. But when you get in the editing room, you have a chance. If you know your structure very well, you have a chance. And I've done this several times. You have a real chance to restructure the movie. For example, on JFK. The X scenes with Donald Sutherland were originally in two parts. There was the middle, and then it was planned for the end, to have an ending wrap-up. And we abandoned that after we saw it, and we combined the two scenes in the middle, which makes it longer. And also, if you look closely, he's not wearing the same hat, or I forget exactly what it was, or changes in clothing. But we managed to align those and make it work. But that's the kind of restructuring that has to go on sometimes if in a radical position where we're down to the movie now and it has to work or not work.
It's hard for all of us to edit our own stuff. So the fact that you wear these many hats, that's probably a virtue for you, right? Because because you're making a movie and what you wrote, you see, doesn't work when you're working with the actors. Or you produce, you create a movie, but then in the editing room, you're able to go back and say, no, this is all wrong. This should be first, and that should be
last.
It's
a three-step process. One is, and the end result, the editing is very much like the writing process. Often I will co-write because I can't get into all the research. At the beginning, I'm working on another film, and I used to do more films when it was easier to make the films, but I can't start sometimes. I'd hire a writer I like, who'd work on the thing, and then I'd come in and we'd hash it out.
And is it disappointing that a lot of times your screenplays are not made into movies?
Sure, yeah.
And is it because you can't get the money or the zeitgeist changes?
There's all kinds of problems. So yeah. The Martin Luther King problem was the family. Mm-hmm. We got down and dirty with post-1965 Martin Luther King. So he wasn't a Time Life magazine kind of character. And that was just very difficult. We had problems with Evita.
And you also with Me Lie.
That was a horrible situation. We were 2 weeks from shooting, or 3 weeks from shooting. And the stock market crash, and then the producer was looking for an out. It was a massacre movie. It was too grim. The usual problems, you know, like Platoon. They were always scared of Platoon because it was a bummer. Me Lie Massacre is not exactly. But it's done in a way that was really interesting. It was an investigation by General Piers, who actually ran the investigation. So it was it had two levels. This is a movie. The man who believes in the military, and he finds out what really happened that day. He's a general. He's a three-star general, a true character, Ray Piers.
And I get the sense that time and money are the two albatrosses on your head all the time.
No, movies are fragile. You know that. It's all marketing, too, now. You know, so much marketing. And they oversell. I mean, everything is specialized too much, you know. You can't take a big shot and just do one. In the old days, I guess it didn't cost as much. But now everything is so deliberative, you know, investment for one of these houses for anybody is so big because marketing costs are so expensive, which is one of the problems with America. We have, our marketing costs are ridiculous. In other words, you can make a movie for very little, but then you got to spend three times as much marketing the damn thing because everybody in America markets and market. I mean, our culture will suffocate on marketing, don't you think?
Yeah, I think. And consumerism.
Don't you think?
Yeah, we're in agreement. You wrote, you told an interviewer many years back this, I consider my films first, and we're talking now about your feature films. I consider my films first and foremost to be dramas about individuals in personal struggles. And I consider myself to be a dramatist before I'm a political filmmaker. I think what links all my films, from Midnight Express to Scarface, Salvador, Platoon, and Wall Street, is the story of an individual in struggle with his identity, his integrity, and his soul. In many of these movies, the character's soul is stolen from him or lost, and in some cases, he gets it back in the end. Is that's an old interview that I found. Is that still true?
I like that idea. I mean, it's not always true.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I love the idea, and you should add a her here and there, too.
Yes.
Because the character in Heaven and Earth very much is tested very, very harshly.
As is Alexander's mother.
And Alexander's mother. What a great character. I loved her. Yes, I would like that. There's all these variations on that, but that's essentially correct. That's the closest you could come to saying that that's the body of work.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Nixon, you wind up in both Nixon and W., actually, what you describe the events that were going on at the time the movie takes place. So the history is there. But your research leads you to probe the psyche of both W. and Nixon. And in Nixon, there's an interesting thing going on here. You discovered that he had had two brothers who died and that the two Kennedys had died. And so you make that a theme in your movie.
Yeah.
So that is where Oliver, the researcher, becomes the dramatist, the interpreter.
Well, in Nixon's case, it was very interesting because I don't know if it was an idea suggested by a psychologist or not, but I remember being very affected because Nixon benefited from the deaths of his two brothers. The death of his older brother allowed him to go to law school, to Duke, and the death of his younger brother, I forgot what the effect was, but it helped him.
Yeah, TB, the brother.
Yeah, that was the older brother.
Yeah.
The younger brother had another disease. But I remember those two, and then when the two brothers, Robert and John, would go down, I remember he was affected by it. And I think Nixon was affected, the details I read. But remember, we're psychoanalyzing here, and we're going beyond the history facts.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's sitting in the Lincoln Room, which is his favorite room, remember? We don't know what the hell happened behind those doors except one time when Kissinger says we prayed together. And even there, we had to invent the dialogue. But when he's alone with the portrait of Nixon and he talks with the portrait of Lincoln and he talks to Lincoln about the Civil War, Abe, you went through what I'm going through now, the Civil War. That identification with Lincoln is very important. And I think we made a real point about the suffering that Nixon was feeling. And I don't think people give him any understanding of that suffering. And I think that some people resented the movie because it made them, they thought, too empathetic. I didn't think so. I thought it was sensitive. And I think Nixon was very sensitive to hurt. And the rejections he'd felt in his life, the hatred of Kennedy's class superiority, these are very important factors in any politician's life.
In Nixon goes to China. And there's an exchange with Mao. And you have Mao say to Nixon, you are as evil as I am. We are the new emperors. We both are from poor family. Others pay to feed the hunger in us. Others pay to feed the hunger in us. And then he goes on to say, in my case, billions of reactionaries. In your case, millions of Vietnamese. Civil war is always the cruelest kind of war, but our two nations were forged by revolution, United States and China. Is peace all you're interested in? Mao asks Nixon. And then he says, the real war is in us. history is a symptom of our disease.
Ooh. Well, that's total dramatization, believe
yeah.
me. That sounds great, but in reality, I think it was probably very, I don't know, it would be, you know, there are accounts of it from Kissinger and
yeah.
so on.
But what I'm saying is you're making an interpretation here. I'm not saying, you know, where what book did you find this in? Let's go back to the hidden history.
Who knows
now.
If Mao was even sensitive at that point or sensible, because, you know, there's two interpretations of Mao, because he'd done so much opium and so much sex and he was so degenerate. Mm. I wondered how much of his brain was there at that point, you know? I think for Mao, it was the way out of the Cultural Revolution. He was in a mess, you know. He was also running into problems because he had pushed the limits on that Cultural Revolution. So I think Nixon was his out. And for Nixon, Mao was his out. It was an interesting kind of game they were playing.
I have identified several themes in your hidden history. And one
untold
is...
Untold history.
The documentary.
The untold history.
The untold history of the United States, and one of the themes is the leaders who were bypassed, the leaders who might have brought us in a different direction if they had lived or had not been screwed by the system. And here you do this amazing mini biography of the Vice President Henry Wallace. And, of course, Kennedy falls in this category. You mention George Marshall, Gorbachev, as individuals who could have changed the course of history but were denied that opportunity. And, in fact, this is also true of Alexander. So there is a similarity in what you're saying, what you have... the historian in the movie, played by Anthony Hopkins,
Ptolemy, say
about Alexander. Fair yeah. comment?
Very good, very astute.
Okay.
Because I think they don't understand it unless you say that the feeling in the movie is that Hephaestion and Alexander were both assassinated young. The army was fed up. They didn't want to go on. Alexander's plan was to go back to the to Babylon, and then from there launch a new whole invasion of the West, going to Arabia, going down through Spain, through and attacking Italy, and going out to the gates of Gibraltar, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were exhausted. They had a lot of money. They were millionaires, all these generals. And what the f***? And we're going to go on with this guy. We're never going to get out of here. We want to go back to Macedonia and spend the dough. And so Ptolemy explains that, and he became, in fact, the pharaoh of Egypt. He was the luckiest of them all. He actually emerged with a dynasty that lasted through Cleopatra. But the concept of men acting for real reasons, for material wealth, and comes to play in the Alexander story. So he was cut off. That's the point.
Yeah.
And at the age of 33, if he had just gone back and administered the empire from Babylon and not gone on with it, that would have been a tremendous achievement, which he was anyway, because his contribution created a culture around the world, a new culture, which was inherited and, in a sense, perverted by Rome. But Rome did take his idea and keep running with it.
And in the case, we're jumping around now, but because both of the documentary and the film comes late, or recent works of yours, Wallace could have been vice president. Could have been president. But Roosevelt was denied the choice
yep.
at his fourth convention
yep. Yep.
By a group of party officials,
yeah, party
including Paulie, for whom
Paulie and Flynn,
ballroom, I think, is named here.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, not this room. But so what you're exploring is kind of alternative history, what might have been. And I want to throw something out here. You, in researching JFK, went to see McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were leaving, you asked him something like, what did you miss? And he told you that Kennedy made him see the stars.
Yeah, that's right.
And that is a theme that you see in these heroes that you're identifying in the hidden history, and they're real heroes.
McNamara was as hard-headed a man as I've ever run into, as you know.
Yeah.
It was a serious, but for him to say that line at the very end, because it was a very unsatisfying meeting. It was like, you know, he was in that place where he was ambiguous. He's defending himself, and yet he knew he was guilty. Mm-hmm. He went through hell. I mean, Johnson treated him like it was just an awful experience for him. And he felt horrible about the deaths of 3.5 to 3.8 million Vietnamese. Horrible. Anyway, that's a great line, and he did. Yeah, I forgot about that.
And the line is in Alexander. So there's a we're running some things.
It all goes into a suit.
All right, and then I want to ask to identify one other thing, because we're coming to the end of our time. But the beast, the beast is your way of describing the structures that essentially subvert history. And in fact, at some point, the beast becomes conspiracy because you're looking for actors. And I guess that's where some people fault you, because they say, well, there's no conspiracy. It's the system, the way it all hangs together.
Well, that's what Nixon says at the he says this Wall Street. He talks about this complex that he's built up since World War II. And he says, the girl and the young student at the Lincoln Memorial that night at 4 in the morning, although this is dramatized, too, she says, you can't control it, can you?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have control of this war.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, and I honestly, I think all of us have to wonder, who does? Mm-hmm. Can a president really do anything anymore in our country? Obama promised so much, and I'm sure he meant some of it, most of it. But I don't think he was aware of the realities. And I think when you get into power, it's so encumbered by such a, you know, we have so many agencies of government. It's such an insane bureaucracy now. It's like Roman Empire. That how do you, you almost can't act. You can't move too much in the, you're like embalmed in the center. And I have a fear that because the military industrial complex has gotten so fat and so rich, as has the security industry, as has Wall Street, all these have grown. And how can anyone take that on now? You take a Roosevelt in 1930, you'd have to have a depression of that order so that a Roosevelt, and Obama had that moment. You remember they were comparing him to Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. In 2009, early 9, he could have got, there was such a popular sentiment writing with him, and he could have taken it on if he had the guts. When you read, what was the first thing he did? He hired people like Gates and Clinton and stuffed his and the old economic team, and then he asked all his followers on the internet, all those grassroots organizations, to stand down. That was one of the things he did. He said, and then he made this vague remark, "Well, come and protest, and you know we'll drive this through." But it wasn't like, why break up that organization that he had? Mm-hmm. That first 100 days, you can't do much. You have to move. Mm-hmm. So that was a blown opportunity, a huge blown opportunity. Many people gave up on democracy. At that moment, it seemed like that was an expression of genuine people's will. I just want to say one more thing. So I would think, in just looking back at it historically, remember Jimmy Carter in our history tries really hard. In those 2 years he goes very, very liberal. He tries to do things, as to some degree did Clinton, but not as much, but Carter. And then they surrounded him with Brzezinski, among others. Mm-hmm. Remember him?
Yes.
Remember all the reactions to any move that Carter did? Anyway, they froze him. So my argument was that Kennedy was the last one who really could do it, because he could end that Cold War. He would have won election in 64. He would have won for sure. And can you imagine another 4 years where he really has more power than the first 4 years? And of course, there's his brother behind him, too. I can see why he scares the shit out of the people who... were conservative.
And the possibility here is in the American University speech.
Beautiful.
Which he gave before.
And his actions. His actions, which were not... He was a man of peace. He had been in war. He understood war. Roosevelt was a man who had suffered. He had polio. You need these kind of men who have strength. When I read about Obama after the election, you know, a lot of friends had told me, but I didn't really read up on him, I realized that, well, what was his experience? He was they call him a consensus builder. That's what he did. He never was a confrontational man. Mm-hmm. He had no history of confrontation. mm-hmm. which we missed that. By the way, on Wallace, I just want to say one beautiful thing about Henry Wallace. I don't know that he would have succeeded as president, but if he had become president, because that's why the Democratic Party, the hacks didn't want him, because they knew he was not, he didn't have a political bone in his body in a way. He wasn't, and Roosevelt knew that, I think. And if you look at Frank Castiglione's new book, Castigliolo's book, Roosevelt's Last Days with Stalin and the Grand Alliance, you see a man who's so tired in Roosevelt. He's exhausted. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, he could concentrate on the war. He's running the world. He's running World War II, and he has 4 hours possible of mental concentration. That's the body, the age, the... You know, if Roosevelt had lived, I kept saying this, another 100 days, the world would have been different because he would have guided that peace through Japan. There would have been, I don't think, any bombing of Nagasaki or Hiroshima. The bomb might have been turned over to an international tribunal. And I think there would have been a different mindset to the beginning of this new era. So this is how the body fails at a tragic moment. This is how history is not just the beast. History is also accident and human,
bad decisions,
human vulnerability.
And bad decisions. Fortuna, powerful interests. These are. I'm reading a list which I jotted down as I watch, historical and media obfuscation. And then the rise of the negative character. The Forrestals, the Cheneys, and the others who rise.
Dulles.
Alan Dulles, who Talbot
and
is
Foster
writing.
Dulles.
Yeah.
And George Bush.
So let's make this our last question, and then we'll turn to the. And that question is why this new direction on your part? Why did you do the 12 part history of the U.S.?
Well, because I'm an older man, and you know, I've lived through this so many wars now. I've lived through such a strange era, and I thought I recognized my country. I think this was a mourning for my country. This was something to say, what happened? You know, I'm reached a certain age in my life. I was 60 years old when I started that series, I think, and what went wrong? What is this George Bush character? And this is two terms. They reelected him in 2004. Is this America? Is he an aberration? Or is he... I found out after 5 years that he's an exaggeration of a policy that was in place going way back. Mm-hmm. And you can find a lot of... this policy was set by this hero, this false flag hero, Woodrow Wilson. But also, you know, this World War II is what set it off. That was a key moment when Truman took over. And I think there's many good things about Truman, but my God, he really blew it. If there was one small individual who, and George Bush called him his favorite president, I remember, there was like a weird, small-minded kind of thing. Condi Rice said he was the greatest president of the 20th century.
But I want to bring up something else. You were dissatisfied with your daughter, high school history books?
Disgusting. Disgusting. High school history in America is disgusting. You can get this at graduate school. There are many good professors who would agree with this, but you cannot get it in high schools because they're controlled by the Texas school boards and the California school boards, and they're compromised deals. They write, you know, I don't know if you've ever been asked to sit on those committees, but they write little sections, and they compartmentalize you to death. We wanted to do a big history. Anyway.
Well, Oliver, on that note, it was a delight to have you back, but it was a great delight to force myself to go back and watch all of these movies and the documentaries that accompany them. And I recommend everybody else do it also, because the richness of what's there is quite something.
Thank you.
So people have submitted questions from through email. So let me ask you some questions, and I'll end up with that Bernie question in a minute. How would you advise students to prepare for career movies?
There's about 2 million of you. So it's a tough call, because each one, you have to find your way to your soul. You have to have something you want to say. Feel. And I think life experience is crucial. I really do. I think if you go to a film school, it's important to learn technology, technique, very important, but it's also in conjunction with real life experience, whether it's closely observed family relations or your own ability to deal, your sensitivity to things around you. my work always got better as I went along, but I did write some grandiose scripts that were lacking verisimilitude. So I think it's a struggle. And I wrote a lot of scripts, as you said, about 12 screenplays before Midnight Express got done, as well as many, many treatments since then and many scripts since then that were not made. Face the rejection, and you have to be very strong, because for every success, you might have 3 failures. I'm not going to be falsely encouraging on that.
And it's probably gotten much worse since you started out.
Well, I think there's a lot more, but on the other hand, the technology has improved so much that you can make a film cheaply. We could not do that. We had to really struggle to get a feature done in the 35 millimeter. Now you have many choices. On the other hand, you have much more competition, so your film has to stand out at all these million festivals that they have. So it's hard too, but at least you get to make it. And a lot of people learn a lot by making it. And sometimes it strikes that gold. But I do think movies are, you know, in their renaissance, kind of, I mean, right now we stopped and just looked at the films of the last 100 years. There's enough there, for me anyway, that I could just sit there and watch.
And what do you think of the independent film community and what they're producing?
Well, it's very specialized. Very specialized,
yeah.
Very small, and very incestuous, I suppose, in that way. You know, I'd like to see big subject matter, but I realize you don't have big money to do it, but maybe you can figure out a way to do it intelligently, like the conversation between Socrates and McNamara or something.
Yeah.
You know, in a room. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do cheap movies. I did talk radio, but in a radio station, with just in monologues mostly.
What do you hope to achieve in the Snowden movie?
I never set out to achieve except to make it entertaining and to make it interesting, and I think the movie will deliver. I think it was an enormous effort. We had no studio support. It was an independent movie. That's to say, we really had to work outside the system. We were nervous about the system because at that time, NSA and Snowden were very controversial. But we made it in Germany as a German movie, with French money and German money and some American money. We have a very good distributor, a small one called Open Road, but they're good. They actually did Spotlight last year, which was another sleeper. Remember Spotlight?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which so they actually can do it. You know, we're facing those odds because it's also the election period. No one's talking about Snowden. No one's talking about surveillance state at the election candidates. No one's talking about climate change. So it's kind of a weird election aside from reality. It's a comic book election. But, the Snowden thing will cost so much more to just... If you advertise Snowden in the television, which is what you have to do in America, imagine you have to... All the prices go up. So it's very difficult to bring out a film, which they want to bring out in September, September 16. I hope some of you will show up. It's a thoughtful film. It's a thoughtful film, and we really did a lot of research.
Some of these questions have names attached to them. Margarita, an undergraduate, asked, what measures have you implemented or seen in action as a producer in Hollywood to ensure diversity in film? Do you think other Hollywood producers are actively working toward equal representation of women, people of color, any marginalized community on screen?
Well, yeah. This is a tough question. You know, I did produce South Central, which was a very interesting story about the black community in Chicago and the kids who go to jail. This was a 1990s film. Very very loved in that community, in those communities, but did not play on a big scale. Couldn't get big distribution for it. We also did Joy Luck Club, which was about the Chinese, a wonderful book by Amy Tan. And it was about two generations of Chinese mother and daughter in America and in China. I loved that movie. What else did I Platoon, at that time, was introducing new characters that had not been seen before. Many of them were African-American.
Yeah, and in fact, that needs to be emphasized, because when you go back and look at Platoon, it's peopled by all the people who were there, and the black soldier and the underclass are really represented.
Very important part of the movie. They were very important to me too, because it gave me. I always argued and tried to say this was, it was that black soldiers that really kept me human, because I think there was a dehumanization in that whole process, and without marijuana and music and that friendship that they gave me as a young nobody white person who didn't know shit about it was special. And the music was special, too, that they showed me. So, and the marijuana, too. anyway, that kept me human. I think I got out of Vietnam. I got out of Vietnam because I kept that side to myself, which was interesting. It's a sociological experiment.
In the documentary on Alexander, Angelina Jolie emphasizes how you brought out the strength of the character in your directing of her.
Yeah. No, she was a very strong character, though. Olympias was one of the highly independent women. She got herself in a lot of trouble, and she was stoned to death eventually, but very outspoken. She was, you know, all women through history, the ones who stand out. And she would have stood out in any age. Right today, she would have been out there on the front lines. She was, you know, the whole plot of that movie depends on her involvement or not in the murder of his father. Because I remind you, when Alexander goes off to Babylon after his father is murdered, there is a lot of suspicions that he was involved in the murder of his father. He wasn't, I don't believe. But whether the mother was becomes an issue. And the mother wanted him to be great. She always claimed that it was that Alexander was the product of her and a god. Because in those days, they didn't know the process. They didn't know the process of insemination and so forth and how that worked. The uterus. So it's very likely that she probably believed it. She had laid with a god one night when the thunder struck. You know, why not? People believe crazier things today. They believe in you know, the earth is only 5,000 years old and that climate change is not upon us.
As you talk about Alexander, I was reminded of something, which was 20 years ago when I did the interview with you. You were talking about your being so controversial. And you say in the interview, I bet that if I went back in time and made a documentary about Alexander, I would be trashed by the critics for misrepresenting what really happened. So Alexander was on your mind even back then.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I wanted to do that in film school.
Here we have a question from a young lady who is Vietnamese, Tho Han Nguyen, and she writes, when she was very young in Vietnam, I'm paraphrasing here, she missed the opportunity to meet you. And this was at a time when you were considering making Pinkville. She writes, when that little girl came home and realized she had missed a chance to meet her idol, she was devastated. Now, 9 years later, she would like to finally ask you a question in person. So here's her question. I'll read it. Can you tell us whether you still plan to make the movie Pinkville, and can you share some of the difficulties that you faced in turning this horrific massacre into a movie? Most of all, you went to the village itself and saw the images of the massacre in the museum. What were your thoughts then, witnessing the scar of such a traumatic event and standing right at the village where the massacre took place?
It's a very powerful experience, and anyone who goes to Vietnam should go to My Lai. You know, we don't know all the facts, but it's disgusting. Because the movie that we show in the end, by tracking all this information that General Pierce found, General Pierce was a three-star general who didn't believe that it had happened. He found like 500 people were murdered that day. And he put the blame not on William Calley or that the Medina, who was the captain, or on the major. He traced the whole thing through records to the top, to the division commander. Not only did he trace it to the division commander, and in an area that was even much more murky and never quite came out in the commission, he traced it to the CIA information. The CIA information on that village on that day was that anybody in the village on that day was a VC. So it was open fire zone. And that was told to the captains, to the lieutenants, and worked its way down to the men. This is a day for a killing. So, because they said that ample warning had been given the villagers. All this was all false. And the CIA, by the way, and this is an interesting parallel to modern times, the CIA, in giving this information to the Army, because it was a CIA war, don't forget that they had a lot of behind-the-scenes control. Westmoreland was the front man, but behind Westmoreland was a CIA network that gave him all this information. They got that information specifically on My Lai through torture. And it goes to show you that under torture, you don't get straight information. You get false information. So they ended up killing almost 506 people in cold blood. And they're all, the ghosts of My Lai are still there. You feel it. If you hang around, I was there at night one time, early night, and I just, it's chilly. You know, you feel that the ghosts are there. We had Leili with us, Hayslip, and we had all the, we built this village in Thailand, but it was, we had, in the real village, it was very spooky.
And why was the movie never made or painted?
I told you, there was a, this is a, the problem of writing these kind of movies, because it was a, such a hard story that to them, they were worried about massacre. American soldiers killing people. This is during Iraq War, right? Mm-hmm. And during Afghanistan War. So definitely there was a bias against it. But then, and it was an excuse with the stock market crash in 2007. It was about to happen, but the companies were suffering that they pulled out. They pulled out.
So money and time again and again.
Money and time. I mean, it was a tough movie to make. It still exists. Can I make it? I don't know. We had quite a bit of money against it, $6 million. We spent building everything.
I believe you once said that you shot Platoon to participate in the healing process of the nation. Can you elaborate on this idea and maybe on a more global picture what you believe is the relationship between trauma, memory, and cinema?
I think Platoon was a healing experience for many veterans. I was told that, and I felt it when I saw them, and they wrote to me, and there were so many beautiful letters. And still to this day, you know, people say that that movie affected me, and you had to be there to understand that moment in 1986. So there was a genuine healing that did go on. However, Reagan came into power in 1980, and he introduced the idea to the public that the Vietnam War was an honorable one, and that there was nothing to apologize for, and that we had done this for idealistic reasons. And he proceeded to, he expanded on that, and every president since then, including Clinton, including Bush, including Obama, have seconded the idea that the war was nothing to be ashamed of. So this is where the government and the people are going in two different directions. And this happens a lot. So this is not a government that, as Henry David Thoreau said many years ago, this government is a disgrace. And on the certain issues, this government is a disgrace. That's, Thoreau said that, I didn't say that. But I really think that this is we've reached a disgraceful place. And there's no going back. It's just like we get worse at the lies and it snowballs. So the trauma has continued. We never recovered from Vietnam, never. Never apologized. You know, it was this genocide, if whatever you want to call it. It's not, but we carpet-bombed that place. We destroyed it. And Laos and Cambodia, and we created the Cambodian War. So who's kidding who? I mean, this is all insane, all because of the domino effect that Vietnam was going to go communist. Well, the whole world's changed since then. You know? Now we want Vietnam as an ally because we're so scared of China and we have to contain China. This is, you know, this is all politics on an order of, I think C. Wright Mill said it best in the 1950s. Those of you who remember him, he was a sociologist and a historian. He wrote, this country, and he was talking about Eisenhower and Dulles, he said, this country, his leadership is one of crackpot realism. You know what that means? They think they're being real. When they create this paranoia of power, if we don't have power, the Russians will get it. The Chinese will take it. There's got to be a boss. And they keep justifying building more and more weapons, bigger and bigger. We spend 5 or 7 times what the Russians spend on their military. They're scared of us. So and the Chinese are building up now. But who leads the way? We keep leading the way. Crackpot realism.
Okay, 2 more questions. One is, what do you think about what's going on television? Do you think that television is changing and we're seeing more creative stuff, or not really?
Don't ask me. It's
okay.
I don't know. I mean, I love some of the shows, and you know, but I think that's such a waste. can be such an educational tool, but you can't make something that criticizes America too much. You have to be really careful, and that's true. I mean, look, come on, Dante should have been on the air. I mean, allow a debate, stir the air. They don't allow that. And the loudness of the commercials, the amount of commercials, you know, defeats. Do you watch the news? I've watched it a few times.
That's
like
a joke.
Infotainment or something. It's it's a cutaway to the commercial.
Yeah. We know that the audience is so enthusiastic about our discussion of the hidden history of the United States.
Untold history.
The untold. Sorry.
It's your age.
Yeah, it's my age. Thank you. Yes, I'm learning that every day. They're going to go out and buy it for their children and their grandchildren. But what I want to do is say, if they watch it, then what is the evaluation, do you think, that they will come to about the current campaign and the Bernie movement?
He was a great hope. I don't say he would have been, he wasn't particularly brilliant on foreign policy, but who can talk about that? Mm-hmm. Who can talk about the military-industrial complex? Yeah, well, that was a mistake, too. Chavez had actually a very interesting electoral record, 16 times that his government was tested. Every time they were fair elections, they had a paper ballot and electronic ballot, which is what we need in this country. We cannot live off this electronic ballot. There's too much corruption. In fact, I don't know why the United States cannot have a popular vote. I still don't understand it. I guess I never studied civics, but let's have a straight-out vote. I feel I'm not empowered because I'm a resident of California, and I'm so behind the time zone that by the time the vote comes up, it doesn't matter what California votes. Same thing is true about the primaries. If 3 million people in the U.S., in New York, are independents, and they can't get on the ballot as a Democrat, something's weird. And Sanders suffered from that. It was a pretty close vote, actually. Sanders he was only like 300,000 behind without just registered Democrats. And it was declared by the media that love Clinton, you know, a sweep, a resounding victory for Clinton. Well, actually, if a popular vote across the country, I'm all for multi-parties like they have in Europe and South America. Let's have multi-party system, 5-6 parties. And you join a party, no one has the majority, but you'll make if you have those 5-6 parties and you have a 30% vote or a 23%, you form coalitions in these governments, and that's very productive because each party represents the people who are really out there. If you're a right-winger and you want to vote for Ted Cruz, you have that party, that Ted Cruz party, but he's got to get along with these other people, so that makes for more of a democracy. I say a popular vote and multi-party.
On that note, Oliver, I want to
thank you. Thank you, Harry.
You're the first artist that we've had for the Elberg Lecture, and this has been quite wonderful, discussing your movies and responding to the audience. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.